Tonight's program is entitled The Flight of the Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. And what we're going to be doing tonight is taking a look at information which has been gleaned from documents from World War II that surfaced decades after the conclusion, or the official conclusion, of that conflict. These documents present a very different picture of the eventual fate of Adolf Hitler, the evil German dictator whose machinations did much to plunge the world into the Second World War, and beyond that, the individual whose philosophy, or the individual to whom this a philosophy was ascribed, the philosophy that was ascribed to Hitler is one which has an overriding significance for those of us here today. Fascism and Nazism are only too real in calendar year 1993. Beyond that, the program tonight is significant for what it tells us not only about intellectual history in general, but beyond that, what it tells us about the integrity of historical inquiry in the 20th century, because the mythology of Adolf Hitler's suicide, and as we shall see tonight, that is exactly what that is. It is a mythology. It is a well-documented mythology. That is to say, the fact that it is mythology is well-documented. It is not real, unfortunately. Would that it were. As I indicated a couple of minutes ago, I have not in the past ascribed a great deal of historical significance to Adolf Hitler's probable survival after World War II. This is for a couple of reasons. In the first place, the real powers behind Hitler were the really significant aspect of the Third Reich. Hitler's role was that of crowd pleaser, and when Nazism, when the Third Reich became an underground political force, which it did after 1945, it did not disappear, and beyond that, the Third Reich did not, in fact, lose World War II. Rather, they went underground and pursued a long-term political strategy which proved fruitful and victorious, and which so far has brought about the conquest of one of the Third Reich's major enemies, namely the Soviet Union, and it has gone a long way. The Third Reich's survival strategy has gone a long way towards conquering its other major enemy as well, i.e., the United States. When Hitler officially, when he left his position as head of the German Nazi Party, in my opinion, his political significance disappeared at that point. Serious students of the Second World War have long viewed the allegations that Hitler committed suicide with grave skepticism, no pun intended. Indeed, tonight we're going to take a look at, among other things, just how flimsy the official version of Hitler's fate really is. The quote evidence, unquote, which has lent weight to the suicide theory of how Hitler, the suicide theory of Hitler's fate at the end of World War II, is remarkably transparent and remarkably flimsy. What is really significant, though, about tonight's program is what it reveals about the world that we live in, what it reveals about the political forces that controlled the world in 1945 as well as 1993. Beyond that, what it reveals about how they affect our look at history, because as we shall see, the reason why Adolf Hitler's probable escape was covered up was because the forces which helped him escape were in fact already assuming their position in the post-World War II world, in the Cold War, and beyond that, the politics which have dominated the 20th century from 1917 to the present, or up through the end of the Cold War, I suspect those politics will continue to dominate in the form of Nazism. But certainly the struggle between the forces of capitalism and the forces of Marxism, socialism, communism, whatever you choose to call it, that is the struggle which dominated the 20th century. World War II, much of the period before that, and the period afterward, have been determined by that struggle. And indeed, the official obfuscation with regard to the fate of Adolf Hitler is inextricably linked with the political forces that were at work in 1945, and it is inextricably linked with the political forces that are at work here in 1993. And it is the significance of those forces and their ability not only to affect the circumstances of our lives, but also to affect the intellectual history that we come to believe in that is really the significance of the program this evening. As I said, Hitler was essentially the crowd pleaser of the Third Reich. And in my opinion, when Hitler, quote, committed suicide, unquote, as we shall see, he almost certainly escaped, his significance as a political entity disappeared. Nazism, on the contrary, did not disappear in 1945, and it did not, in fact, the Third Reich did not, in fact, lose the Second World War. I can appreciate that that will sound absolutely wacko to the average new listener. In appreciation of same, I refer listeners to Radio Free America program number 37. Hours and hours of documentation dealing with the subject of how the United States lost the Second World War. And I refer the interested and the skeptical to that massive archive show. A listener during the phone-in session last week had the observation that, in fact, the Third Reich disappeared at the end of World War II, and that in his opinion that I apparently was placing too much emphasis on the forces of the Third Reich and their influence on the 20th century. This is not to take issue, or this is not to put down that particular listener, but rather I think the questions raised by that listener, who'd been listening a period of some months, were very good questions. And indeed, though the questions that this listener raised, I think in many ways frame the debate, the CRP, they frame the scope of the discussion this evening. Indeed, conventional history has it that as we look back and forward from the vantage point of Halloween 1993, conventional history has it that fascism itself and Nazism in particular was an aberration, that it was a bunch of evil people making everybody go crazy, and then something terrible happened, namely World War II. But after World War II, the Allies made everything right again, or they would have, except for nasty old Joe Stalin, who also he hypnotized all the Russians and made them go crazy. In fact, the picturing of fascism and Nazism as an aberration, as a sort of evil happenstance without any overriding long-term historical significance, is a fundamentally it's a fundamentally incorrect analysis. As I have looked at in numerous archive shows, fascism is inextricably linked with multinational corporate capitalism, not coterminous with it by any means, but because of the doctrinaire anti-communism of fascism in general and Nazism in particular, many of the top industrialists and financiers and political figures in the Western nations, the United States, Britain, and France, were openly pro-fascist and pro-Nazi, and many more were not overtly hostile to them for that reason. Indeed, in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, in the Uncle Sam and Il Duce program, the first two Radio Free America shows, Radio Free America number 10 and RFA 37, I took a look at the profound, the inextricable link between fascism and multinational corporate capitalism. Beyond that, within the multinational corporate community, the Germans themselves, and the Nazis in particular, have assumed a significant and I suspect soon to be dominant role. If in fact they do not have enough control already, I think they soon will exert a dominant influence within the multinational corporate community. For purposes of conceptualization, I view the multinational corporate community as in effect a crime syndicate, and just as elements of a crime syndicate work together, so too there are rivalries between elements of that crime syndicate. I think much conventional progressive political analysis fails to note the role of German nationalism as a force in 20th century world history, and tends to view fascism itself as an international class phenomenon exclusively. It is, of course, that, but there is much more to it than that. And indeed, what we looked at in Radio Free America 37, how the U.S. lost the Second World War, was basically how the Berlin mob gained primacy over the Washington gang and the London syndicate, so to speak. And in a sense, what we're going to be looking at this evening and what we have looked at in weeks past and will look at in weeks ahead is an element of just how the capo di tutti capo, so to speak, of the international multinational, of the multinational corporate crime syndicate, well, the capo di tutti capo is going to be named Fritz for quite some time to come, not Joe or Reginald. And what we're going to be looking at this evening is part of the history of how that happened. One of the things that we looked at in Radio Free America 37 was the Nazis' habit of using anti-communism as a vehicle for conquest. They learned early on that their opposition to communism could be used to curry favor with nations, elements of nations they sought to conquer, and that in fact they could very effectively establish sympathetic fifth columns within nations that they proposed to conquer, by touting their anti-communist sentiments and winning sympathies of industrialist financiers, military and intelligence people, and political figures as well. Beyond that, we took a look in Radio Free America number 37 at the Reinhard Gehlen spy organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that jumped to the CIA at the end of World War II and became, in turn, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and in 1955 it became the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German Intelligence Service. It is now the German Intelligence Service. And even after its incorporation as the BND, this institution, formally in its first incarnation, Fremdenheer Ost, or Foreign Armies East, the Third Reich's Eastern Front Intelligence Outfit, it continued to supply the CIA with a vast bulk of its information, and it continued to supply NATO with a vast bulk of its intelligence on the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, even after it became the West German Intelligence Service. It is an institution which, in my opinion, is unique in history, in that here was a direct projection forward of the Third Reich's national security establishment, of its general staff, philosophy, and prime methodology, and of its intelligence services. And this direct projection forward into history of this primary element of the Third Reich's national security establishment placed it at the very core of NATO, which, as we looked at in RFA 37, in turn represented a development of the Christian West concept, a Third Reich contingency plan for surviving military defeat in World War II. The Christian West concept entailed a Hitlerless Reich, a Third Reich minus Adolf Hitler and some of the more obnoxious elements of Nazism, to join with the United States and Britain and France and other European nations in a pan-European and transatlantic anti-Soviet alliance with the Hitlerless Reich as its cornerstone and a foundation. That basically is what NATO became. Another of the great myths of the Cold War, and one of the great enduring myths of contemporary history, is that Germany was denazified at the end of World War II. That was not the case, and not only did the Nazis have their situation deeply entrenched, or they were deeply entrenched, by 1945, too deeply entrenched to be completely rooted out of society, but beyond that, because of their anti-communism, and because of the things that the West felt they had to offer for the coming struggle with the Soviet Union and its allies, the Nazis were able to perpetuate themselves in power in Germany with a thin democratic facade in the quote new unquote Germany. This placed the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi spy outfit, this Eastern Front intelligence organization featuring thousands of SS and Gestapo veterans. It was not only the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, at the same time as many top Nazi scientists, some such as Wernher von Braun and others who were with the SA and or SS, were incorporated at the very core of our defense industry. We took the cream, so to speak, of the Nazi intelligence system, placed it at the very core of our intelligence system, where it remained and continued to be the intelligence core for both NATO as well as the CIA after it was already a functioning intelligence service of West Germany in 1955, and as such represented a direct perpetuation of the Third Reich's intelligence service. This intelligence service, it should be remembered, was working for a country which was essentially also a perpetuation and a projection forward of the Third Reich. The political leadership, the courts, the judges, the civil service, the intelligence service, the military, general staff, as well as industrialist financiers and corporations were all those of the Third Reich. That is to say, those in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany were the same as those in the, quote, old, unquote, Germany. And it is in recognition of the fundamental distortions that exist in our picture of what has happened in the 20th century, and in recognition of the fundamental distortions of our picture of what happened in World War II, that we are taking a look back at just what exactly happened to Der Führer, just what exactly happened to Adolf Hitler at the end of World War II. Indeed, just as Nazism was presented as a scary aberration, so too Hitler is presented as a scary aberration. Neither is accurate. Nazism was not an aberration. It was an inevitable outgrowth, in my opinion, of forces that are very much at work in the world today. And Adolf Hitler was not an aberration either. And indeed, as the suicide myth has become an established element of 20th century history, also an illusory one, it's worth examining how the myth of Hitler's suicide came to assume the value of truth, because in examining the working of those forces, both the forces that helped Adolf Hitler escape and those which, for whatever reason, and they're not necessarily the same reasons, saw fit to help to obfuscate that escape, to help cover up that escape. By examining these forces, we can learn a great deal about the world that we live in today and a great deal about the world that we're likely to be living in for many years to come. Tonight's program is going to be derived exclusively from a series of publications, or a series of editions of a quarterly called The Military Advisor. I was sent a number of articles from various issues of The Military Advisor by a listener, and research credit on all of these goes to that listener, and a big tip of the hat to the listener. We're going to begin by taking a look at The Military Advisor. That is a quarterly. It is subheaded The Publication for International Military Hobbyists and Historians. We're going to begin by taking a look at The Military Advisor, Volume 4, Number 1, Winter of 1992 and 93. We're going to take a look at an important historical discussion, namely the distinction between revisionist history and academic history. And this, I think, will help to focus the discussion this evening on the way in which history is, the way in which our conception of history is generated. As pointed out accurately and eloquently in this article, academic history is history which is generated to support a particular point of view, not necessarily a scholastic point of view, but rather academic history is history generated in order to support a view favored by a vested interest. Revisionist history, by the same token, seeks to revise history. Yes, some revisionist history is blatantly slanted and false, but on the other hand, when there is official obfuscation and official dissembling, a revisionist perspective is necessary in order to regain or retain an accurate picture of what has happened. And the version of Hitler's fate that has come down to us is demonstrably false, and as I said, we're going to be taking a look at how that myth was perpetuated and what actually happened to Adolf Hitler this evening. We're going to take a look, first of all, at the discussion of revisionist versus academic history, and after that, we're going to take a look at a brief discussion of the official versions of Hitler's death, both the version that was generated by British intelligence and Sir Hugh Trevor Roper, and also a version that was generated by Soviet intelligence, too, and a KGB official named, or KGB officer, named Lev Bezymensky, Bezymensky, and his 1968 book are going to be the brief focus of discussion next. Though these documents are demonstrably false for reasons which we will set forth at considerable length this evening. We're going to take a look next at a discussion of how both Soviet and American intelligence, well into the 1950s, continued to look for Adolf Hitler. There were active efforts on behalf of both American and Soviet intelligence to learn what had actually happened to Adolf Hitler at the end of World War II, despite the fact that officially Hitler was viewed as a suicide. Again, we'll be examining both the Soviet and the Western mythology with regard to Hitler's suicide, quote, suicide, unquote, later in the program. Suffice it to say that at the very, very beginning, in order to frame the scope of the inquiry this evening, we're going to take a look at the political realities that both Americans and Soviets viewed as requiring a search into Adolf Hitler's fate as late as the 1950s. Neither the Soviets nor the Americans believed the official history. Both continued to look for Adolf Hitler, and that'll be the next focus of the discussion. The first major element after taking a look at what is significant about the fate of Adolf Hitler as an intellectual event, we're going to take a look, first of all, at the Soviet history and what is wrong with the official Soviet version of what happened to Adolf Hitler. As I say, the first official Soviet history was one put out, or actually the reigning Soviet history, I should say, was one put out in 1968 by a KGB officer. As we shall see, the premise upon which the positive identifications of Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun were made are fundamentally false. All of the dental records for the top leadership of the Third Reich disappeared in April of 1945. They have never been recovered, so any attempt to positively identify or to maintain a positive identification of Hitler and Eva Braun from dental records is clearly false. As we shall see, all of those dental records disappeared, and the only account that has come forward in history of the actual dental records of the Third Reich's leadership come from Dr. Hugo Blaschke, who, as we shall see, was anything but a disinterested party. He was a loyal member of not only the Nazi party proper, but of the SS, and not an individual, as pointed out in this The next article we're going to be looking at from the military advisor from the fall of 1990. The first story we're going to be looking at is from the summer of 90. Then we're going to be taking a look at the winter of 1992-93. We're going to jump back to the fall of 1990 and take a look at Bezymensky's allegations concerning Adolf Hitler's suicide. As we shall see, these are purported to be based upon comparisons of Hitler's dental records with a charred corpse that was found in the courtyard of the Führer bunker. Since the dental records in fact disappeared, it calls into question very seriously how Bezymensky could possibly have made this particular identification. Again, there have been sketches made both by Dr. Hugo Blaschke and by his assistant, a woman named Heusemann, of what they recalled Hitler's dental work as being. These have been compared oftentimes to some partial x-rays of the head that have survived in the historical annals. But any attempt at using dental records for a positive identification, as pointed out in this story, is clearly fallacious, because the dental records themselves were destroyed. There are some partial head x-rays of Adolf Hitler, which have been public for years, but there are no dental x-rays of Adolf Hitler available, and the only approximations of what Hitler's dental work supposedly looked like have come from people who could be presumed to have participated in an active cover-up of Hitler's fate. Again, Hitler's dentist, Dr. Hugo Blaschke, was a loyal member of the Nazi Party and of the SS. When the Soviets learned that the Americans had Dr. Blaschke in custody, they abandoned all efforts at looking for Dr. Blaschke and the dental records. So, with regard to Bezymensky's analysis of what happened to Adolf Hitler, it is based on the flimsiest of, quote, evidence, unquote, comparisons of some sketches of Adolf Hitler's dental work from memory by people like Dr. Hugo Blaschke, when compared with alleged x-rays taken from the corpses found in the Führer bunker. And as we shall see, there are a lot of questions about whether the dental work on those corpses would have been identifiable. So again, with regard to the Soviet analysis, it is based on comparisons of x-rays on two corpses found in the courtyard, buried in the courtyard of the Führer bunker, with sketches made from memory by Dr. Blaschke. All of the dental records for all of the Third Reich's political leadership, in fact, disappeared and have never been found, calling into serious question any attempt at making a positive identification of Hitler's corpse from dental records. This particular article contains a very good discussion of what is needed to make a positive forensic identification on the basis of dental records. As we shall see, the circumstances surrounding the, quote, corpse, unquote, of Hitler, as well as the disappearance of his dental records, completely negates the criteria that are required in order to achieve positive forensic identification based on dental records. And it is upon such identification that the Soviet allegations in the Bezymensky book are based. After that, we're going to take a look at the official Western, or the most prominent official Western history of Adolf Hitler's alleged demise. This comes from the aforementioned Sir Hugh Trevor Roper, who, just like Bezymensky, was an intelligence operative for his nation. Hugh Trevor Roper was with MI6, British Military Intelligence, just as Bezymensky was with the KGB. And as we shall see, the alleged identification of Adolf Hitler as a suicide by Sir Hugh Trevor Roper is as readily criticizable and as filled with fundamental flaws as Bezymensky's identification, which again is based solely on x-rays from two corpses allegedly taken by the Soviets at the end of World War II. As we shall see, there are serious questions about how accurate those x-rays would have been. Beyond that, the only comparison is between those alleged x-rays of Hitler and sketches of Hitler's dental work made from memory by his loyal SS dentist. Likewise, Sir Hugh Trevor Roper's allegations concerning Hitler's suicide are equally fallacious. First of all, much of the documentation for his identification of Adolf Hitler comes from Third Reich officials and intimates of Adolf Hitler who were in Soviet custody at the time that Sir Hugh Trevor Roper was doing his research. Beyond that, the statements that these individuals made both while in Soviet custody and afterward cast serious aspersions on the alleged accuracy of Sir Hugh Trevor Roper's analysis. Beyond that, there are at least two key sources, two key members of the SS cited by Sir Hugh Trevor Roper, who remain highly questionable. There is no record whatsoever of these individuals being in the SS, so either these were some mysterious individuals improperly identified by Sir Hugh Trevor Roper, or he was simply fabricating evidence. I will leave it to the listener to make up their minds. Suffice it to say that much of Sir Hugh Trevor Roper's, quote, evidence, unquote, is based upon alleged statements made by people who were in Soviet custody when they were allegedly referenced by Sir Hugh Trevor Roper, and their statements in Soviet custody and after their release are contradictory to the information attributed to them by Sir Hugh Trevor Roper. Beyond that, two of his alleged informants, or two of the sources cited by Sir Hugh Trevor Roper, do not have any historical record supporting their existence. There is no record in the SS records of these people existing at all, and they are cited as critical sources by Sir Hugh Trevor Roper. One need not have a PhD in history, I think, to understand the serious problems with an analysis based on people who cannot be located. There is no record of these people existing at all. And much of the rest of his, quote, evidence, unquote, is based upon information allegedly communicated by people, as I say, who were in Soviet custody and whose statements in Soviet custody and after they got out of Soviet custody are directly contradictory to the information that they supposedly supplied to Sir Hugh Trevor Roper. The next thing that we're going to be looking at this evening is a flight that was made on April 26th by a JU-290A6. This was a special German transport which had been adapted as a personal transport for Adolf Hitler. It flew from Germany to Spain, which of course was a fascist dictatorship under Francisco Franco, on April 27th of 1945. And among the things that were alleged to have been on board, as indicated here in copies of the paperwork, the flight manifests, not only Adolf Hitler, but people like some of the people did not apparently, well, they were scheduled just to accompany Adolf Hitler. It remains to be seen how many of them actually did. But the flight manifest for this particular flight, which was supposed to have, which did in fact leave Germany and landed in Spain. Whether or not it actually had these people on board has never been determined. But people like Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, SS General Heinrich Müller, SS General Hermann Fegelein, as well as Eva Braun, Hitler's dog Blondie, or his favorite dog Blondie, all of these individuals and creatures, I guess one could say, are listed on the flight manifest for this particular transport. Again, it is a matter of public record that Hitler's transport, his personal transport, this JU-290A6, landed at Barcelona, Spain on April 27th. The documentation there is very firm, and there are also documents that have surfaced indicating that the plan was to have Adolf Hitler on board this particular plane in order to leave Germany. As we shall see, the individual in charge with the particular squadron of aircraft that of which the two JU-290A6 was one, the individual in charge of this was a fellow named Heinrich Müller. Heinrich Müller was head of the Gestapo, and as we shall see, it was Heinrich Müller who was in charge of Adolf Hitler's escape after World War II. One of the things that is significant about Hitler's escape for our standpoint here in 1993 is that the truth concerning Adolf Hitler's fate was actually learned by U.S. counterintelligence corps agents in interviews with Heinrich Müller, who supposedly died at the end of World War II, just like Der Führer. But in fact, Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, went to work for U.S. intelligence after World War II, and it was during the course of his debriefing by U.S. counterintelligence corps operatives that he discussed what actually happened to Adolf Hitler. And one of the reasons why this remained buried for so many years was that the person who arranged the circumstances for Adolf Hitler's escape and who effectively covered up that escape was the aforementioned SS chief Heinrich Müller, and he went to work for U.S. intelligence after the war. One of the main reasons why the truth concerning Hitler's escape could not have been allowed to emerge in the immediate post-World War II period. We will analyze Heinrich Mueller's work, or what evidence we have of Heinrich Mueller's work for U.S. intelligence, and we will take a look at what Heinrich Mueller told his CIC debriefers about how he arranged the escape of Adolf Hitler. Once again, we will be returning to the military advisor from winter 1992 and 3, and we'll take a look at a distant relative of Hitler's who had been tabbed early on by the Gestapo as an effective double for Adolf Hitler. According to Heinrich Mueller, Adolf Hitler, in fact, left Berlin on April 22nd, ultimately did apparently make his way to Spain, and it was a double, this double who had been groomed as a double for Adolf Hitler, who was killed in the courtyard, and then his corpse and that of, quote, Eva Braun, unquote, were deliberately planted in such a way as to make it probable that the Soviets would discover these particular bodies. Again, the only alleged identification of Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun comes from people whose statements on the record, in fact, contradict what Sir Hugh Trevor Roper attributes to them, or people who have never been discovered at all, people who apparently do not exist, and by information that was compared with drawings made from memory of what Adolf Hitler's dental work looked like. No dental records from the Third Reich's top leadership have ever been discovered, and the circumstances surrounding the alleged identification of Hitler's corpse from dental records are such that they are to be viewed with a great deal of skepticism. In fact, as we shall see in our examination of Heinrich Mueller's arranging for Adolf Hitler's escape, it was the double who was killed and deliberately planted, and it appears that the information given out by Dr. Blaschke was also part of the ruse under the circumstances. Again, Hitler's significance politically was that he was a crowd pleaser. When Nazism became an underground movement, which it did after 1945, his significance faded. He was not significant when Nazism became an underground movement, but it is significant to examine why the mythology of his suicide has persisted to this day, because there are people that have a vested interest in maintaining the current and the prevailing political mythology, and indeed some extremely unpleasant political truths stand to be uncovered along with the truth concerning Adolf Hitler's, quote, suicide, unquote. Again, we'll take a look at the recruiting of the double by the Gestapo and his role subbing for Adolf Hitler at the curtain call of the apparent curtain call of the Third Reich. We'll take a look at how he was substituted for Hitler in the courtyard and subsequently killed and buried, a deliberate plant to be discovered by the Soviets after they occupied Berlin. That, in a nutshell, is what we have on tap for this evening, The Flight of the Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. A Halloween special, a real-life scary story, a true ghost story. We'll be back with the main body of the prepared portion of tonight's program. It's time now for the main body of the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. Again, a Halloween special, The Flight of the Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, a real-life scary story, a real-life ghost story. One of the things that's important to understand about intellectual history is that what was once viewed as accepted fact in many areas of endeavor will eventually come to be overturned. Beyond that, at a distance of time, things which were once taken to be gospel can be seen to have been clearly wrong, demonstrably wrong. There are vested interests, there are political forces and economic forces and religious forces which often work to distort our view of history by promulgating a viewpoint on a particular event or series of events that is beneficial to that interest's, that is in the interest of those interests, I guess one could say. And for that reason, intellectual history is often distorted. For example, it was taken as axiomatic at one time that the sun revolved around the earth. And beyond that, it was a matter of church doctrine that the sun revolved around the earth. Eventually, of course, Copernicus and others that came after him, Galileo and others, determined that the retrograde motion of some of the planets, which could be clearly observed, completely negated the operational view of the solar system, which was that the sun and the stars and the moon revolved around the earth on perfect concentric spheres. This was not the case. However, woe unto anyone who challenged the official history. They were threatened with excommunication and or death for heresy. Some actually received that punishment. I would note that in the 16th century, the Catholic Church actually declared mathematics to be the work of the devil and declared that anyone who was studying it was doing the work of the devil. It was also taken as axiomatic that the earth was flat. Certainly it appears that way, just as it appears that the sun revolves around the earth. But eventually, as human knowledge has increased, these viewpoints, once taken for granted, have been seen to be not only wrong, but to have been fundamentally in error all along. Despite that, however, despite the fact that, for example, it could be clearly demonstrated that the prevailing model of the solar system in Copernicus's time was not accurate, there were powerful interests which had the preservation of the intellectual status quo in mind, and for whom the preservation of the intellectual status quo was beneficial, and they saw to it, at least for a period of time, that even though the facts were in, they would not be taught concerning what the solar system was actually like. As we examine the history of our time, it is also apparent that many historical events have been fundamentally distorted in their interpretation, and that because powerful political forces have a vested interest in this distortion, they not only affect it in the first place, but then perpetuate it through the journalistic and educational institutions which are used to socialize individuals with a particular viewpoint, or socialize them into a particular political viewpoint. This is true of the accounting of the alleged death of Adolf Hitler. It has come to be accepted that at the end of World War II, Adolf Hitler, the Nazi dictator of Germany, committed suicide as his armies were crumbling around him during what has been pictured as the closing days of the Third Reich. As we have seen in numerous broadcasts, in fact, the Third Reich did not disappear, but significant elements of it actually perpetuated themselves after World War II, and in effect, the Nazi state of the Third Reich did not disappear, but rather went underground, went abroad, and survived to a remarkable extent to the world today. Eventually, the prevailing political mythology of our time will be seen to be just that, whereas the Third Reich is viewed as having disappeared in 1945. As I said, it went underground. We looked at that in Radio Free America 37 at great length, and it perpetuated itself. Large elements of the Third Reich were incorporated into the U.S. national security establishment at the end of World War II, where they exerted an immense influence, in part because of the what was deemed to be the political necessity of covering up the work of forces that helped Adolf Hitler to escape. The suicide myth, the Viking funeral myth of Adolf Hitler's alleged demise, has come to be accepted as historical fact, whereas in fact, an examination of the evidence upon which Hitler's suicide is supposedly based reveals that not only can one not conclude from the evidence available that Hitler committed suicide, but that the evidence itself would appear to have been deliberately manipulated in order to arrive at a foregone conclusion. Nonetheless, the suicide myth has come to be accepted as political truth by the American people, and indeed by the people of the world. And we're going to be taking a look tonight at information which surfaced years after the conclusion of World War II, decades in fact, after the conclusion of World War II, which indicates that, in fact, the fate of Adolf Hitler was very different from that which we have been told befell him. We're going to take a look now at one of several editions of a military quarterly that will provide the documentation for tonight's broadcast. This is from a publication called The Military Advisor, subtitled The Publication for International Military Hobbyists and Historians. This particular edition of Military Advisor is Volume 4, Number 1. It's from the winter of 1992 and 93. We're going to take a look at a series of articles by the same author, namely Gregory Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S. The extracts that I'm going to be reading from this first article, again, from the Military Advisor, winter 1992 and 93, are going to come from an article called The Flight of the Wolf, Berlin, 1945. Now, the series of articles that I'm going to be reading to you are scholarly, they're well written, and their documentation for the most part appears to be on solid ground. I do have some differences with the author of these articles, Gregory Douglas. I think that in some places he was a little too trusting of the superficial statements of people like Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo and also apparently an employee of U.S. intelligence after World War II, there are some things in here that I think are misinformation, and it may be that there are other elements of misinformation which have escaped my gaze. But for the most part, as far as I can tell, the actual discussion of the circumstances surrounding Adolf Hitler's demise here is on a very, very solid ground, and a lot of it checks out with other documentation that has surfaced over the years. I want to emphasize, though, that I cannot vouch either for or against the military advisor as a general source. I'm not familiar with it. It would appear from the articles I've seen here that it is what it represents itself as being, and again, its subtitle is The Publication for International Military Hobbyists and Historians. This particular set of articles is an excellent set, and the information appears to be very, very scholarly and well documented. But I cannot say how characteristic this is of the military advisor. So those of you who might want to subscribe, bear in mind that I'm not speaking either for or against it. Obviously, this publication is capable of producing some excellent documentation, but I'm not familiar with its overall track record, so to speak. And indeed, I think there are some serious errors in some of the interpretations of history that are made by the author Gregory Douglas. Nonetheless, this is a very important series of articles, and we're going to kick off tonight's discussion with his analysis of what he calls academic versus revisionist history. And revisionist history, we should note, generally has a negative connotation. To a certain extent, at least, that is justified. There are revisionist schools of history which are explicitly aiming at or have aimed at distorting the past, such as the No Holocaust revisionism that is gaining steam in the 1990s. However, I would note that academic history itself traditionally has enormous distortions in it, and that if we are to clear away the static that is deliberately placed into the historical record by forces that have a vested interest in maintaining the static, if we're to clear that away, then we're going to have to revise in considerable measure our view of the world and of our own history. And at least part of that revision is what we're going to be engaging in this evening. The author Gregory Douglas writes of academic versus revisionist history, "Those who can write on historical subjects can be fairly divided into two basic categories. The first are termed academic loyalists, and the second, revisionists. The former are not necessarily associated with an institution of higher learning, but are reasonably scholarly, although generally lacking in practicality. The loyalist aspect applies to their attachment to a government, political or religious philosophy, or individual on whose behalf their writings are produced. This work is often executed for money or its equivalent in a societal structure, and entails the willingness to hew to a particular line of thought or purpose without regard for any alternative." An excellent analysis, I think, of the pressures that are brought to bear on anyone attempting to relay the historical record. The powers that be want the record to serve their interests, and I think this is a very eloquent framing of the scope of the debate here. Continuing. "The revisionists are historical writers who challenge, through revision, the historical theories produced and defended by the representatives of the establishment. Needless to say, those who espouse the official versions of history view the revisionist as a direct and dangerous threat to their professional reputations and those of their clients or patrons. Although in theory most governmental archives are open to all who seek information, in practice, those who challenge the official views of an establishment are rarely given access to important records and the archival cooperation that is bestowed as a matter of course on the loyalist researcher. The revisionist always has a serious uphill struggle against the entrenched entity and many simply give up after encountering the endless delays, missing documents, and unavailable records so common to their disapproved and possibly dangerous activities."